carry them on along after the end of the service. But as John said, we're going to be picking up in a series on the Ten Commandments, and this is picking up in our series on the book of Exodus. So we've looked at the book of Philippians together, we've had Easter looking at the Easter story together, and now we're just going to come back to looking at the book of Exodus. And it'd be really easy for us just to rush into this and approach these Ten Commandments in a kind of a vacuum and just see them as a to-do list, something that we just got to do. But the fact is that there's a huge backstory that has led up to this point where God is speaking, to his nation, to Israel. And if we're going to relate to this in the right kind of way, we've got to get our heads into that story. We've got to immerse ourselves in that story. So that's what I'm going to do just as an introduction, is try and condense 18 chapters of the Bible into a short 2 minutes, just to get us thinking in the right kind of context, just to know what's happened so far. And then we're just going to go from there. But yes, that's what we're going to do. We have to look at what's happened so far in the book of Exodus. So for the longest time, the people of Israel had only known slavery in Egypt. For generations, they performed back-breaking labor, building cities. And despite the fact that they were oppressed by their captors, the Egyptians, their population grew and grew and grew, to the point where the Egyptians were fearful of them and their numbers. At this point, Egypt's pharaoh, Egypt's king, ordered that any Israelite baby, born a boy, should be thrown into the Nile, that all the girls could live. Life was hard, brutal, and short for the Israelites in Egypt. But one Israelite mother could not bear to lose her newborn son. She hid him, she concealed him for 3 months, and when she couldn't hide him anymore, she took a basket, made it out of reeds, covered it in tar, so it was waterproof, put her baby in it, and in an act of desperation hid her baby in the reeds on the edge of the Nile. But in God's providence, it just so happened that Pharaoh's daughter came down to the river to bathe and found the baby boy, adopted him, and named him Moses. So this boy, Moses, grew up as a son of Egypt, of the royal household, but he could not turn his back on his people. One day he went to go down and see them and see the conditions that they were living and working in, the harsh conditions, and he saw an Egyptian beating one of the Israelite slaves. Looking around, seeing that no one was watching, he approached and he killed the Egyptian. When he found out that the Egyptians knew what he had done, fearing for his life, he fled Egypt and made a life for himself as a shepherd out in the wilderness. He married, he grew old, and he had children. But then, one day, when he was out tending his father's flock in a place called the Mountain of God, God came and met with him. God spoke to him from a burning bush and said to him, "I'm sending you back to Egypt to deliver this message to Pharaoh. Let my people go." So Moses took this message back to Pharaoh. Pharaoh refused. Pharaoh was obstinate. And then what led on from that is God revealed his power and his authority by bringing down 10 different acts of judgment on Egypt. Finally, Pharaoh relents and lets the Israelites go, and they head off into the desert, led by Moses. But as they're heading off, Pharaoh changes his mind. He decides, "I'm going to get my army together, I'm going to pursue them, I'm going to capture them, I'm going to kill them." And when the Egyptian army are closing in on the Israelites, God provided protection by creating a barrier of fire. As the Israelites travelled on, they reached an impassable sea, but God provided a way through by parting the waters. And as the Egyptian army pursued the Israelites from behind through the parted waters, God brings the water back in on the Egyptian army. They travel on into the desert, where they have no food, when God provides bread from heaven. They travel on, they have no water, God provides water from a rock. They travel on and they're attacked by another nation, another group of people, and God provides victory for them over their enemy. And finally now, they have reached the Mountain of God, the same mountain where God met with Moses before all of this happened. Now, as we come to our passage, Israel are standing on the brink of something new. All they have known so far is slavery in Egypt. All they've known is how to be slaves. But now, as we pick up back in our series in Exodus, we're going to see that God is calling them to leave behind their past and live as his nation, his people. Over the next few months, we're going to be looking at the Ten Commandments, which are the beginning and they're also the heart of a section of the Bible called the Law. Now, this is a section of the Bible where God is giving Israel, through Moses, instructions and guidance on how to live as his people. we're going to see God speaking to Israel about how to live as his people who are no longer slaves, but are people that belong to him. So these next few passages are a hugely significant, pivotal point in Israel's history. And the fact is that they can be hugely significant for us too, if we let them. Through the law, God is establishing the culture of Israel, what it should be, what they should value, how they should treat one another, how they should treat outsiders, how they should settle disputes, how they should worship God rightly, and on and on. In other words, we're going to get a front row look at what God said, God, our Creator, says about how life should be lived. These words that we're going to read over these next few months, the words that we're going to read this morning, are here to challenge us, they're here to encourage us, they're here to spur us on in living life as it was made to be lived. And these words are also here to get us to evaluate ourselves and see our own hearts more clearly, to evaluate our motives and actions in the light of what God says is good and right. This can make some very uncomfortable reading for us over the next few months, and I really pray that it will for you and for me. And I also pray that through it, we will get to know God better, know ourselves better, and be empowered and encouraged with God's help to live as his people. So that's where we are, that's where we're going. So let's get into our first three verses in the first commandment. So reading from verse 1. And God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. So here we are, right at the beginning of the Ten Commandments, the beginning of the law. And the first thing that God says isn't a command. It's not a command. Instead of telling them to do something, the first thing he does is remind them of something. God reminds Israel of the relationship that they have with him. He describes himself as the Lord their God. Like, if you look in your Bible, you see that Lord there is written in block capital letters. That signifies that God is using his personal name there, the name that he revealed to Moses when he spoke to Moses through the burning bush. And this name carries the meaning of being an uncreated, self-existent, self-defined being. So this self-existent God, who's higher than everything else, who created everything else, describes himself as their God. Can you hear the sense of relationship and commitment in those words? God has tied himself to this group of people. They are his people and he is their God. And then God goes on to remind them that central to this act of him making them his people was an act of rescue. He reminds them that he was the one who brought them out of slavery in Egypt. He was the one who brought down the 10 acts of judgment on Israel, on Egypt. He was the one who parted the Red Sea, who led them through it. He was the one that provided water and food and protection for them in the wilderness. So right now, at the beginning of the Ten Commandments, God is reminding them that he has rescued them and made them his people. So why is this important? Is this just like a nice way to introduce the important commands that God's going to start to give them? The fact is that these words are the key to Israel understanding how they should relate to the law, to what God is about to say. And they're also the key for us understanding how we should relate to what God is about to say as well. They tell us, and the Israelites, that the relationship between God and his people existed before the law was given. Before God gave a single command, Israel had a relationship with God. God had already tied himself to them as a people. This means that when we read the law, we're not reading a method or a way for people to work their way towards having a relationship with God. They already have that. Rather, what we're reading is the way they are to live out their relationship with God that they already have. I think a helpful way of thinking about this is like a marriage. When you get married, you make vows to each other, you make promises about how you're going to live, how you're going to treat one another, to love each other in sickness and in health, to be faithful to one another. And if a husband or a wife breaks those vows, that is a violation of that relationship, but it doesn't mean that they're not married anymore. They're still married until the point where they both or one of them walks away. And the law is kind of like wedding vows. The law is a picture of how Israel are to conduct themselves in their relationship with God. But it is set in the context of a relationship that depends on God's love for his people, not on their ability to keep the law. There are consequences, serious consequences, if Israel breaks these laws, if they violate that relationship with God. But when they do break these laws, that doesn't mean that they are no longer God's people. They are God's people because God has rescued them. They're God's people because God has made them his people. So what does this mean for us? So in the same way that the Israelites can look back and they can see the events in Egypt and see God taking them through the Red Sea and know that they're his people because God has rescued them from slavery, if you are a Christian, you too can look back and know that you belong to God, no matter all your performance, because Christ is our rescuer. We can look back and we can see Christ living the perfect life that we could not live. We can look back and see Christ taking the punishment for sins that we cannot bear. We can look back and we can see Christ dying the death that we should have died. We can look back and we can see Christ rising from the dead and conquering death, so that through him, through a relationship with Christ, we can have a resurrection, a new life. A life as God's people, reconciled to God, adopted into God's family as his children. So when we come to the law, when we come to the law in the next few months, we come to it through Christ. We come to it in the context of a relationship with God. This is not a rod to beat ourselves with. It is not the means by which we are to impress God and make him like us and let us get close to him. It is God speaking to us, revealing how we are to live in a way that honors the relationship that he has given us with him, in a way that matches who God is and the values that he has. So that's the way that we need to relate to the law. So with this in mind, let's finish by looking at the actual first commandment. So the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. I think it's an interesting question to ask, why does God start with this? You know, if this is going to be about how Israel is to conduct themselves and live as his people, surely there are thousands of things that he could have said, thousands of things that he could have started with. But why does he start with this? Well, the answer to that question is because it's fundamental. It's a fundamental command. I think a good way to kind of illustrate this is, a year or two ago, I was at work, and a new guy joined the team. We were just kind of talking a bit. I got to know him a little bit. And talking about a weekend, you know, as you do, like, oh, you know, what are you going to do? I mentioned that I was going to be preaching at church. And he looked completely shocked. I just didn't know how to react. And then he said, I had no idea that you were religious. I had no idea you were religious. So you know, I felt a bit proud about that. You know, like, oh, great, I'm not one of those religious, crazy people. And then I asked him, well, why is that a surprise to you? Why does that seem strange to you? And he said, it's just that you make jokes like the rest of us. I wouldn't expect a religious person to do that. Ouch. Like, I don't know if you've ever had one of those moments where you just get blindsided by conviction from the mouth of someone that didn't even intend it. And after thinking and praying about that, what I realized is that I was placing such a high value on making friends at work and being accepted at work that was controlling the way that I spoke and the way that I acted. I placed a higher value on that than representing Jesus there and introducing people to him. And this shaped my behavior and it diminished my witness. That is why this command is fundamental. The thing that is most important to you is the thing that you worship. And the thing that you worship controls everything about you, how you live, how you act, everything. It controls how you see yourself, how you treat other people, how you talk, how you use your money, what your priorities are, what you will sacrifice things for, and so on and on. Everything. So when you worship the approval of others, you'll be constantly trying to do what they want you to do, not what you know is right. If you worship comfort and security, you won't be sacrificial at all. You won't be a giving person, but you will hoard your wealth, your resources, and your time. If you worship another person, you will let others get hurt if you think it's going to serve that other person, and you devote yourself to them in an unhealthy way. What we fixate on, what we worship, filters through into every aspect of our lives. So when God starts the Ten Commandments with, you shall have no other gods before me, he knows that this comes before any other command that he could possibly give Israel. There is no way that Israel can follow him, can obey his commands, if they're not obeying this command, to have no other god before him. The fact is that if we worship anything less than God, it does incredible harm to us and to the people around us. But if what we fixate on, if what we worship is God, that will do incredible good to us and to the people around us. If God is the one that we worship, the one that has a prominent place in our hearts and our minds, we'll value what he values. His priorities will become our priorities. As we go further through the Ten Commandments, we're going to see what God values. We're going to get a bit clearer picture of that, what that means, what his priorities are, and therefore how we're supposed to live. But if we don't start here, if we don't start evaluating, what am I worshipping? Who is my God? Then any kind of act of obedience that we try to give God after that, it's just going to end up as hollow rule-keeping. We're going to end up as Pharisees. That's what we're going to be if we don't start with this point of worship for God. You know, a really quick way to figure out what it is that you worship is just to ask yourself, what do I want most right now? What is it that I want most? What is controlling my behavior? And like, as I've already kind of said with that example I gave you, my workplace, so often that isn't God. So that often my priorities aren't his priorities. So what can we do about that? The good news and the bad news, in a way, is that it's something that only God can do. We can't change our hearts. I can't make myself worship something, or can't make myself worship God instead of the things that I naturally want to worship. It's something that only God can do. But it's also something that we're called to actively participate in. In Philippians, the book that we've just looked at, there's a really helpful passage that talks about this, how those two things work together. In Philippians chapter 2, from verse 12, it says, "Therefore, my dear friends," this is Paul talking to a church, a group of Christians, "as you've always obeyed, not in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose." They are commanded to work out their salvation, to live out their salvation with fear and trembling. But they're also told that it's God who's at work in them, so that they will think and act in a way that pleases God. Now the encouragement that we can take from this is that no matter how you look at your heart, and you see all the things that you worship before God, and you see your inability to free yourself from worshiping those things, you need to know this morning that it is a work that God is going to do in you. One day when we stand before him, when we see him as he is, it's just as that song that we were singing says earlier, and we will worship him as we ought to, when we see him as he is. But between now and then, there's an ongoing act, an ongoing process that God is doing in our lives, making us love him more, bringing us closer and closer to him. And there are ways in which we can actively join in this work that God's doing in us. And one of the main ways is just through identifying these areas of our lives where we're worshipping something other than God. So to name it and to confess it and to pray. And also to get a clearer picture of what it means, to love God and worship him above all other things. I'm just going to close now by reading the words of a psalm. That really give you a picture of what it means to answer that question, what do you want most right now, with to be near God. To be near God. So the band are going to come up now, and I'm going to read this psalm. And as I do, we can reflect on it, think about it, and this really is my prayer for us this morning. And as we go through the rest of the Pentagon, it's that we would have hearts and attitudes that match this psalm. So if you want to read it along with me, it's on page 595, or if you just want to listen and just reflect, that's great as well. But I'm going to read this, and then the band are going to lead us in a song to close. So Psalm 84. "How lovely is your dwelling place, Lord Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. Even the sparrow has found her home, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may have her young, a place near your altar, Lord Almighty, my King and my God. Blessed are those who dwell in your house. They are ever praising you. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. As they pass through the valley of Baca," that means valley of suffering or valley of dryness, "they make it a place of springs. The autumn rains also cover it with pools. They go from strength to strength, till each appears before God in Zion. Hear my prayer, Lord God Almighty. Listen to me, God of Jacob. Look on our shield, O God. Look with favour on your anointed one. Better is one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. For the Lord is a sun and a shield. The Lord bestows favour and honour. No good thing does he withhold from those whose way of life is blameless. Lord Almighty, blessed is the one who trusts in you.